Today, I will discuss with you a controversial figure from the history of philosophy and literature. She's a famous philosopher, artist, and critic, and is the American author Susan Sontag. Let me first tell you a little bit about her biography and her background. Susan Sontag was born in 1933. She grew up among the large community of Jewish immigrants who lived in New York that time. So you might compare her to Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt, who was also a child from a Jewish family and who was also living as an immigrant in New York. But Sontag was also quite unlike Arendt. So unlike Arendt, for instance, she was born in America, not in Europe, and her parents did not come from Germany, but they originally came from Eastern Europe. So she belonged to a much younger and very different generation of Jewish immigrants than Arendt. After the Second World War, Sontag went to study literature and philosophy at the universities of California and Chicago. She would eventually marry her sociology teacher, who goes by the name of Philip Reeve, when she was only 17 years old. She then moved to Europe, studied at the universities of Oxford and Paris. Upon her return to the US in 1959, she divorced from Reeve, and she began a relationship with the American-Cuban director and writer Maria Irene Fornes. In New York, Sontag worked as a lecturer at various universities. She debuted as a novelist and essayist. In 1967, she caused a small storm of controversy with a comment in a periodical called the Partisan Review, and the comment went as follows. I quote, "The truth is that Mozart, Pascal, Boolean algebra, Shakespeare, parliamentary government, Baroque churches, Newton, the emancipation of women, Kant, Marx, and Balanchine ballads don't redeem what this particular civilization has wrought upon the world. The white race is the cancer of human history. It is the white race, and it alone, its ideologies and inventions, which eradicates autonomous civilizations wherever it spreads, which has upset the ecological balance of the planet, which now threatens the very existence of life itself." End of quote. So as you can hear, Sontag was from the beginning of her career firmly on the leftist and progressive side of the political spectrum in America. Do not forget that these were the years of the Vietnam protests, the civil rights movement, the murder of Martin Luther King, the activism of students, sometimes very violently repressed, the age also of political art, etc., etc. And Sontag was at the very heart of this. During the following decades, she became known as the conscience of the American left. In addition to her literary and philosophical career, she was also often in the spotlight as an activist. In the 60s and 70s, this social engagement was also to be situated on a personal and a sexual level. She was a famous voice of the feminist movement, and she openly expressed her bisexuality. After Fornes, she also had relationships with choreographer Lucinda Childs, painter Jasper Johns, artist Paul Tech, and from 1989 until her death, photographer Annie Leibovitz. The diversity of Sontag's interests is reflected in her work. She devoted essays to topics as diverse as the difference between art and camp, the French poet and theatre director Antonin Artaud, the German philosopher Walter Benjamin, and the fascist aesthetics, as she called it, of Leni Riefenstahl. So her output was very diverse. Then, in 1977, her book On Photography was published. It quickly became famous as one of the first comprehensive reflections on the role that the camera played as a mass consumer product in post-war society. I will return to this book at a later moment to discuss it in depth. Sontag frequently spoke out about current issues in the public forum. She stood up against the fatwa of the Iranian Ayatollah Khomeini against the book The Satanic Verses from 1989 by the British writer Salman Rushdie. At the beginning of the 1990s, she moved to Sarajevo, the capital of former Yugoslavia, which was besieged by Serbian forces. This is at the height of the Yugoslavian War. During the siege, which lasted more than 4 years and during which more than 300 grenades per day were fired at the city, Sontag stayed in the city to direct the performance of a theater play, namely Waiting for Godot by Samuel Beckett. This might strike you as a bit strange. Why Waiting for Godot is this famous play in which nothing happened. It's one of the famous plays of absurdist theater. And some saw her staging of the play as conceited and naive. Other people, on the contrary, interpreted it as a courageous and hopeful signal for the people of Sarajevo. In 2003, the year before she died, Sontag published her last book. It was called Regarding the Pain of Others. She returned in that book to the topic of photography, and she especially focused on the effects of visual overload of images of violence within a visually oriented culture such as ours. In December of 2004, Susan Sontag died of the effects of leukemia. So now, let me turn to her philosophy of art, more particularly her philosophy of photography. In what follows, I'm going to discuss Sontag's ideas on photography. I'm going to look at three steps in her development. First, of course, there's the book On Photography from 1977. Then I'm going to look at another book called Under the Sign of Saturn. It's actually a collection of essays, and I'm going to focus on one essay, which is called Fascinating Fascism. It's about the filmmaker and photographer Leni Riefenstahl. Then, to conclude, I'm going to say a few words about her last book regarding the pain of others. So, during her long career as an essayist, Sontag frequently returned to the topic of photography. She was especially interested in the many roles that the spread of photography had played in post-war culture. Her book On Photography was the first step of that intellectual development. It contained six essays that analyzed the new mass culture of photography. You must know that only at the beginning of the 20th century, photography did become accessible to a broad part of the Western population. Before, it was a luxury product. A typical example of this development is the slogan with which the American company Eastman Kodak advertised their cheap new camera in 1900. It was called the Brownie Box. The slogan went, "You press the button and we do the rest." End of quote. It meant everyone can take a picture, which was not self-evident at that point. At that moment in time, photography was still a matter for specialists. Doing photography before 1900 mostly meant that you were a chemist, that you knew how to handle chemicals, because doing photography was such a complicated chemical process. The second crucial turning point came during the 1960s, when the price of both photographic film rolls and the products for developing them was greatly reduced. That moment coincided with the arrival of a new and affluent generation, the baby boomers, who could afford to travel. Tourism became a status symbol for this generation, and the photo album became the material proof of that new status for friends and family. Pics, or it didn't happen then already. So Sontag describes some of the cultural consequences of the rapid spread of photography. She talks, among other things, about the explosion of visual culture. The photographing eye is insatiable, as she has it. Her analysis of the popularity of travel photographs in cultures with a strong work ethic is well known, and I will quote her here. "Travel has become a strategy for accumulating photographs. The very activity of taking pictures is soothing. The method especially appeals to people handicapped by a ruthless work ethic. Germans, Japanese, and Americans. Using a camera appeases the anxiety which the work-driven feel about not working when they are on vacation and supposed to be having fun. They have something to do that is like a friendly imitation of work. They can take pictures." End of quote. The visual culture that emerged in post-war Western society has resulted, according to Sontag, in a constant and overabundant stream of images. Sontag points to the double status of photos. They offer a picture of the world, but they themselves are also part of that world as material objects. Now, it's useful to keep in mind that Sontag is strictly talking about analog photography. All of this is happening before the advent of digital photography in the late 1990s. So what does she mean exactly by the omnipresence of photographs as material objects? Well, she means that photographs are printed, reduced, enlarged, retouched, and reproduced. They end up on billboards or in photo archives. They are published in magazines and newspapers. They are preserved by the police in photo collections or exhibited by museums. Photographic images, Sontag observes, have become an integral part of our daily environment. The result is that photos are starting to function as a determining influence on our visual education. They dictate what is worth looking at and what is not. Moreover, they also make us less sensitive to images of extreme situations. Think of pictures of violence and death, which enter the public debate through photojournalism. Sontag's appraisal of the changing social functions of photography was undoubtedly inspired by the extensive documentation of the Vietnam War through photojournalism. It was the first war to be reported so extensively through the lens of the camera. Its horrifying images have become iconic. Think of the photo of the Vietnamese girl running away after a napalm bombing, taken by Nick Ut in 1972, or the photo of the execution of a Viet Cong prisoner, taken by Eddie Adams in 1968. Okay, now let's turn to the second step of Sontag's reflections on photography. Here I will discuss the essay Fascinating Fascism from her book Under the Sign of Saturn from 1980. In 1974, that's around the time that Sontag was writing her book on photography, an intriguing photo book was published. Its title was The Last of the Nuba, and the book documented the traditional way of life of the Sudanese Nuba people. But it was especially the author and photographer's name on the cover which caught the attention of the audience. That was the German actress and film director Leni Riefenstahl. At the beginning of her career, during the interwar period, 1920s, Riefenstahl had been famous in Europe as a dancer, actress, and director of adventure films, which were often set in the mountains. The central themes of her film were the beauty as well as the dangers of the mountains and the conflict between a heroic individual, often played by Riefenstahl herself, and a conservative and hostile community. European film audiences, not only in Germany, adored these films. One of her many fans was the German Nazi politician Adolf Hitler. In the course of the 1930s, Hitler invited Riefenstahl to document the political meetings of the Nazi Party. Together with his Minister of Propaganda, Joseph Goebbels, Hitler was convinced that film could be an efficient instrument to inform and indoctrinate a nationwide audience. The result was that Riefenstahl made several films on behalf of the Nazi Party. The most famous of these are Triumph des Willens, in English Triumph of the Will, from 1935, and Olympia, from 1938. Now, if you look at Triumph of the Will, it was a quite direct and unambiguous propaganda film for the Nazi regime, showcasing the rows and rows of soldiers and party members in uniform. The second film, however, Olympia, was more insidious. It was in itself not a film about the Nazi movement, but by means of a detour, it was still a celebration of the Nazi movement or the ideals of the Nazi movement. It was namely a groundbreaking two-part film about the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin, taking place after the takeover of power by Adolf Hitler. And what Riefenstahl did in the film was to celebrate not Nazi power directly, but she celebrated many of the ideals of the Nazi Party, namely physical strength, physical prowess, doing sports in group, physical training, endurance, the beauty of the body, the aesthetics of sports, the aesthetics of the movement, and so forth. Fast forward to the period after the Second World War, and Riefenstahl obviously had a problem. How could she dissociate herself from the Nazi regime? How could she place a distance between her and the Nazis? Politically speaking and legally speaking, she was safe. Just like other cultural and philosophical supporters of the Nazi regime, think of Martin Heidegger in the domain of philosophy, think of, in music, Herbert von Karajan, the famous conductor. Well, just like them, Riefenstahl got off quite lightly. All three of them were convicted of collaborating with the Nazi regime, but in the lightest degree. They were called Mitläufer of the regime. So they ran with the regime. They were sideline supporters, so to speak. They were did not actively contribute to the crimes of the regime. It was judged. Still, artistically speaking, how could she rehabilitate herself? How could she reclaim the artistic credibility that she had had before the war? Riefenstahl did her utmost to undo the association between her name and that of the Nazi regime. She tried to present herself as an autonomous artist. These attempts, and why they were doomed to fail, were the topic of Sontag's analysis, which she published in a well-known essay under the title Fascinating Fashion. It's that essay that I now want to focus on. How does Sontag analyze this post-war attempt at rehabilitation that Riefenstahl is undertaking? Sontag starts off with the blurb of the Nuba book. On the back cover is a short, what they call a blurb. It's a short bio, a short biography of the author. And the bio is rather euphemistic, to say the least. Riefenstahl, for instance, she probably wrote the blurb herself. She describes Triumph of the Will as a documentary. The word propaganda is never mentioned. And that's quite, well, it's a bit lightheaded to call Triumph of the Will a documentary film. It's a bit willfully naive, so to say. How does she get away with it? According to Sontag, her misleading self-description is widely accepted because Riefenstahl repeatedly deploys the concept of beauty. Riefenstahl emphasizes her artistic autonomy with regard to the Nazi regime by using the word beauty. I'm concerned, she says, with beauty, and beauty does not have a political color. Is it not possible, she says implicitly, to recognize the same abstract kind of beauty in the crowds at a Nazi meeting as in the athletic bodies of the Olympic athletes or the naked bodies of the Nuba smeared with white ashes? Is that not simply beauty, something which has nothing to do with politics? No, Sontag says, no. You cannot allow Riefenstahl to get off the hook so easily, to depoliticize her work so easily. The same topics that made her work so successful in Nazi Germany still play a leading role in the Nuba book. Riefenstahl deliberately chose an African tribe with a traditional way of life in which the athletic body, the exhibition of physical strength, and the role of the ceremonial are of vital importance. That was exactly the same as in her previous films. The same Nazi aesthetics is still alive here. Nuba culture, just as that of the Nazis, focuses on the strength of the collective and on the total control of the individual over his body. There are no sick or imperfect bodies on the pages of her book. According to Sontag, all these elements together constitute a true fascist aesthetics. She summarizes their characteristics as follows. And I quote, "Fascist aesthetics flow from and justify a preoccupation with situations of control, submissive behavior, extravagant effort, and the endurance of pain. They endorse two seemingly opposite states, egomania and servitude. The relations of domination and enslavement take the form of a characteristic pageantry, the massing of groups of people, the turning of people into things, the multiplication or replication of things, and the grouping of people things around an all-powerful hypnotic leader figure or force. Fascist art glorifies surrender. It exalts mindlessness. It glamorizes death. End of quote. Zondag's analysis, really shines when she shows how fascist aesthetics are not limited to the historical phenomenon of Nazism. It rather constitutes a system of convictions that have similarities with contemporary phenomena. She draws parallels, for example, with contemporary longing for communal feelings through rock concerts, or the strivings of anti-psychiatry, or the belief in the occult, the popularity of primal therapy, and so on. What these phenomena have in common with fascism is not so much a political conviction as a number of ideals. These are the ideal of life as art, for instance, or the glorification of beauty, the fetishism of heroism and sacrifice, the ecstatic feeling of community, and the rejection of the intellect. Zondag notes, how the anti-intellectualism of the Nazis, for instance, is echoed by that of the hippie movement. Okay, that's the analysis from the second step in her philosophy of photography. Now let me turn to the last step, third and last step, which concerns the last years of her life. And even in those last years, photography remained an active concern of Zondag. Probably it was the rise of the internet and the now even faster distribution of pictures that led her to publish Regarding the Pain of Others in 2003. In that book, she continues the reflections that she had already addressed in 1977. What does it mean for a culture when its members are increasingly exposed to gruesome images? Her starting point is the book Three Guineas by Virginia Woolf. Virginia Woolf is a British famous author. It's a book from 1937, and in that book, the British novelist responded to a question which one of her male correspondents had raised in a letter. The question was, how can we prevent war? Woolf said that the problem of that question was the little word, we. How can we prevent war? It's seemingly a very innocent word, and the male correspondent, the man asking her this question, obviously assumed that men and women were equally concerned about ending war. Now, Woolf asked, is there a we of men and women when it comes to war? And she replies, no. War is not gender neutral. War is male. It is men who wage war. It is women who undergo the consequences of war. Now, in the rest of the book, Woolf goes on searching for something that men and women might have in common regarding the topic of war, and eventually she finds it in their shared reactions of horror regarding the images of war. In her case, since the book is from 1937, she's mainly referring to photographs of the Spanish Civil War. Both men and women, says Woolf, respond in the same way to these horrifying images. But Zondag actually has doubts about Woolf's judgment. Is it true that we all react in the same way to images of war? Is there a we regarding such images of pain and misery? Zondag doesn't believe so, and she firmly states, and I quote, "No we should be taken for granted when the subject is looking at other people's pain." I find this an interesting statement, end of quote, by the way. No we should be taken for granted when the subject is looking at other people's pain. Because there is an interesting connection here to be made with the topic of pain itself. Not just looking at pain of others, but also feeling the pain of others. There's an interesting book about this topic, which is by Elaine Scarry. And the book is called The Body in Pain. It's already an old book from 1985. But Scarry underlines that pain is an incomparable bodily experience. My pain is never comparable to your pain. It is always unique. And Scarry writes, I will quote her also, "So when one speaks about one's own physical pain and about another person's physical pain, one might almost appear to be speaking about two wholly distinct orders of events. For the person whose pain it is effortlessly grasped. That is, even with the most heroic effort, it cannot not be grasped. While for the person outside the sufferer's body, what is effortless is not grasping it. It is easy to remain wholly unaware of its existence, even with effort. One may remain in doubt about its existence or may retain the astonishing freedom of denying its existence. And finally, if with the best effort of sustained attention one successfully apprehends it, the aversiveness of the it one apprehends will only be a shadowy fraction of the actual it. Thus, pain comes unshareably into our midst as at once that which cannot be denied and that which cannot be confirmed. End of quote. Let's go back to Sontag's dialogue, so to speak, with Virginia Woolf. According to Woolf, we, namely we members of the educated class, can only be horrified when we watch war photographs where bodies are torn apart just like houses. But that is not true, according to Sontag. Pictures can serve equally well as propaganda that encourages a certain group of people to engage in even more violence. Woolf regards the pictures as photographs of generic war victims, which is never really true. In that case, you are ignoring the political aspect of the images. Who were the victims? What is the underlying conflict? Who is distributing the image? Who is writing the caption? In order to illustrate her point, Sontag brings up a shocking story from the war in Yugoslavia. The same photographs of children who had died in a bombardment were used for propaganda purposes by both sides of the conflict. Sontag writes, and I quote, "altered the caption, and the children's deaths could be used and reused." End of quote. A war photo can carry many different meanings, Sontag underlines. It is anything but a generic document of human suffering. It can be a call to peace, but also a call for revenge, or even a call for philosophical resignation, because the world is, after all, a cruel place. Okay, that brings me to the end of my discussion of Susan Sontag's photography, philosophy of photography, I mean. Please have a look at this for yourself in the book. Read this quietly and also have a look at the slides, of course. Then, if you're done with that, you can take the test and see if you understand everything correctly. Okay, that's it for today. Enjoy the Easter break as far as you can, and I hope you're in good health. Goodbye.